Over the weekend, the world lost one of the legendary racing drivers, Stirling Moss, a driver commonly described as the best never to win the world championship, but who also represented far more than that. A true superstar who transcended motorsport and whose loss has resonated today, almost 60 years since his top-line career ended. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to pay tribute to Sir Stirling Moss are Mark Hughes and Richard Williams. Well, Mark, just to start off, what springs instantly to mind when you think of Stirling Moss?
On many things, but I think visually, I think of him in his pale blue Dunlop overalls and the white peak cap open face helmet. He's reclined, super relaxed stance behind the wheel, the casual wave of thanks as he laps someone. Everything just looked just so graceful and natural. There's pictures of him showing Jim Clark how to water ski, and he looks like an athlete. He's hold of the rack with one hand and just sort of directing Jim. He just looks so poised. And in life, he was approachable and cheery. But decades ago, I read the autobiography he did, All But My Life, and it was largely completed just before his accident at Goodwood. And what was fascinating about the man in those pages, that emerged in those pages, that contrasted with the Stirling I knew, which was, you know, a long time post his career, was incredible self-belief behind that natural grace. He gives a quote to the biographer that really stopped me in my tracks and when I read it, and it said, "I firmly believe that if I devoted my whole life to it, I could eventually walk on water." Now, that was him in his sort of competitive pomp, but it illustrates that this wasn't an ordinary mortal. It was something, there was something psychologically different that marked him out even from other competitors. And that quote is the thing that I think of when I think of Stirling Moss.
Yeah, and you wouldn't put it past him to have been able to achieve that with how brilliant he was in his racing career. And Richard, well, thanks very much for joining us. Of course, you're a celebrated author of motorsport history, most recently with the excellent work on the life of Dick Seaman, A Race with Love and Death. But you're also a specialist in Moss's era, so I'd recommend your book, The Last Great Road Race, to everyone, which tells the story of the 1957 Pescara Grand Prix, which, of course, Moss won. So what does Stirling Moss mean to you?
Well, I think of being a small boy in the 1950s when I began to read about Stirling Moss in the pages of the magazine I took every week called The Eagle, the boys' magazine. And he was there with other great British sports stars of the time, like Dennis Compton and Stanley Matthews and Reg Harris, the cyclist. But to me, he stood above those. There was something very glamorous about him, I think, because he raced abroad. He was a very patriotic man, and you know, we were all patriotic in those days, as certainly as small boys. And the idea of him going to the continent to race against the Ferraris and Maseratis and people like Fangio was very exotic and exciting. And he seemed to do it all with such elegance and class and chivalry and sportsmanship. And I have to say that, you know, I met him later on over the years, and he never let me down. He never betrayed that ideal in any way. So he was a kind of perfect hero, really.
I think from my perspective, for some reason, it's not anything quite so evocative, but just that number, 212 of race wins in his career. He's the only driver who I happen to have off the top of my head total career race wins. I don't know why that got seared on me, but I presume it was a number I must have encountered when I was younger and obviously reading about Moss in history. So and that kind of underpinned his brilliance. Why do we think Stirling Moss is so resonant? His last race of his serious career, shall we say, was in early 1962. So it's almost 60 years since he was competing at the top level, and yet he's still mourned as if he was competing 5 years ago, and everyone remembers it. So it's amazing that somebody from that era can be so relevant. Why do you think that is, Mark?
I think it carries on from Richard's point, actually. The stature that he carried at a crucial time in history and in this country. You know, the master of this exotic and dangerous art that had previously just been the preserve of demigods from faraway lands, because this was all happening at a time when this country was just emerging really as a motor racing force on the international stage for the first time in the 50s. And I think because of that, because of the times, it would be impossible now to cast as big a shadow as that. No sport now would seem so impossibly glamorous when the world is so much smaller and everything else is so much bigger. And I think he carried that stature, so almost frozen in time, for the rest of his life. And I think it's that. I think it's not just that he was a genius of a driver. We've had a few of those, and they're all deservedly legends. But he's beyond even that, because of the place he holds in the public's affection, particularly in this country.
And I guess that makes him, you know, more than just a racing hero. That's what makes him a national hero, doesn't it, Richard? He's got that place at the centre of British life in that era that's carried over for decades since.
Yes, very much so. Also, I think we cared about him because his career had so many ups and downs, some of which were self-inflicted, like his for a long time, his refusal to drive foreign cars. You know, he was like Dick Seaman before the war. He was very keen that Britain should produce a race-winning Grand Prix car, which led him early in his career to drive a lot of no-hopers, like the Cooper Alta and the HWM and the G-Type ERA, before he finally got his hands on a Maserati. And I think people loved that about him. His, you know, when he had his terrible accidents, like the one at Spa in 1960, when he broke vertebrae and, you know, all sorts of bones all over himself and was back racing inside 2 months, people adored that. They saw something really brave and, you know, and a fondness for competing against the odds. And it was the sort of time when that kind of thing made a big impact, like the ascent of Everest, for instance. You know, people doing things that had never been done, beating the odds. People really, really felt an attachment to him.
Yes, I think it's important to stress to people just how non-British Grand Prix racing was when Moss was rising up. Obviously, we'd had very occasional successes with drivers, but this was before the UK really became the centre of certainly Grand Prix racing. It was a very Italian and German and French endeavour prior to that. But we should also say, Mark, we've seen from all the tributes that emerged, there's so many within motorsport, some people who knew him, some people who, say, racing drivers who maybe met him briefly but didn't really know him. But he seemed to leave an impact on everyone, whether it's a young driver in junior single-seaters today or somebody who was closer to being a contemporary or somebody who will have grown up watching him. It's amazing to have that universality.
Yeah, and I think he became a brand before it was before that was a thing, before he became associated with the sport and with the deeds, and in person he carried that off, and he was exactly as you'd imagined him to be. And so he was post career his profession was just being Stirling Moss, and that was he continued that throughout his life. He was always accessible. He was always in the public eye, so he was always being quoted. If something had happened in current motorsport, it would be very normal to see a quote from Stirling on it. So he remained in the public eye, and I think everybody still knew what he stood for, even those that didn't have a detailed knowledge of his career knew what he was about.
One of the differences between him and Mike Hawthorn and Peter Collins and Tony Brooks, who were his very talented British contemporaries, was that he was very good at presenting himself always. As Mark said, you know, he went about the business of being Stirling Moss, but he did it without being egocentric or overbearing in any way. But, you know, he was always the one who'd be in the adverts for cigarettes or, hair cream or something. and he'd be on This Is Your Life, or, you know, he'd be on television quite a lot. And, you know, he was in the phone book after his career ended. You know, if you wanted to ring him up and get a quote from him, you just looked in the phone book and there was his name and number, and he would answer the phone and he would give, you know, give you a quote, and always, and be pleasant and interesting with it. So he was great at that. And I do think that's, apart from his, you know, unearthly skill and great courage and all those things, I think that's another reason why he rose above all his contemporaries and remained there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his initial rise, because he wasn't somebody who came from kind of an obvious motor racing aristocratic, if you like, background or pseudo aristocratic. He was from a middle class family is the way to look at it. But the way he made himself a professional racing driver was just through just sheer brilliance, wasn't it, Mark? I mean, he was one of the sort of the first star of Formula 3, of the 500s, that he was tremendously successful in, and just that sheer ability behind the wheel is what got him to become a professional driver.
Yes, I mean, there was a little bit of dabbling in the sport. I think his mum had competed in trials, his father had raced at Brooklands and I think once at Indianapolis, but it wasn't a professional. But there was definitely a competitive element in the family. His sister Pat was a trials rider and a very good one. But yeah, the outstanding thing, he was just dripping with talent, and he could do anything with a car. You know, anything the car demanded, he would find its secrets and just perform, because he was Stirling Moss. He was a virtuoso. And it's interesting that as the demands, the specific demands of the driver changed over the course of his career, he was uniformly brilliant. Others were very good in the sort of 2.5-litre era, didn't necessarily continue that form into the 1.5-litre and vice versa. There was some that came up in the 1.5-litre that didn't look anything special before. And the differentiator was in the 2.5-litre formula, which ran until 1960, from 54 to 60. Those cars had more power than grip, and the differentiator was the drift, just being able to hold the car in balance on the throttle and at a high drift angle. But when F1 went to 1.5-litre in 61, suddenly there were these tiny little engines in increasingly sophisticated chassis, so they now had more grip than power. And the driving secret changed. The crucial differentiating part moved back earlier into the corner, and it became about who could best get that direction change, make the whole car's set change early into the corner, so you get on the gas well before the apex. It's about, it would be called rotation in modern terms. Pivoting the car around the outer front tire, but not allowing it to slide too much. So it was about exploiting that outer front tire to the maximum. Moss was the absolute master at both those disciplines, and he bridged that gap effortlessly.
Well, he certainly had that good feel. One of the things he talked about was, because he did a lot of horse riding, equestrian, when he was younger, and that's kind of all about balance, isn't it, and feel. So obviously it was kind of dialed into him quite young, and of course he was driving, I think from about the age of 9, he was charging around in Austin, wasn't he? So I guess that was really kind of developed in him, those skills, very, very young. And often when those skills are absorbed young, you can apply them when you're older. So I guess it was, people always talk about natural talent, but it did come from somewhere, didn't it, Richard?
Yes, and the family was certainly comfortably off. He and his sister Pat, you know, were able to have horses and ride them competitively in show jumping from a very early age. And as Mark said, it was a naturally competitive family. So he got encouragement. You know, there was nobody saying to him, you know, oh, darling, don't do that, it's too dangerous. You know, his mum and dad both went to, you know, his motor races with him. His father, you know, in the prime of Stirling's career, would travel with him to the races. And I think that was pretty important. You know, he was never made to feel he was doing something wrong or illicit. So when, for instance, when it was decided that the British cars he was driving weren't good enough, it was his father and his manager, Ken Gregory, who went to Maserati and bought a 250F, you know, which enabled him to be competitive at the highest level. They spent £5,500 on it, which Stirling ruefully said later was actually his money. But they took the initiative, you know, and that was his dad doing that. So, you know, though it was a good setting in which to become a Grand Prix driver. He wasn't fighting against adversity in that way, but he could put all his competitive instincts into fighting on the track.
It is interesting how he broke through, because there's always talk about the fact he wasn't entirely embraced by the motor racing establishments initially. Obviously, there were suggestions of a bit of anti-Semitism around, which I guess wouldn't have been unusual at that time. But I guess the point where he really breaks through is with that 1950 TT success in Tommy Wisdom's Jaguar, isn't it? That gets him into the Jaguar Works program, who'd initially not been interested in him, and it just all goes from there, doesn't it? That's the point where he really breaks through as a professional driver.
Yeah, he'd been turned down for a works drive in that race by the Jaguar team on the grounds that he was too young and inexperienced. Actually, the race was on the day before his 21st birthday, and Tommy Wisdom, the very experienced racing journalist and racer, said, okay, well, drive my XK120 and Moss 1 beating the works cars, which was really a big marker in his career. And after that, of course, the works team invited him to drive for them at Le Mans and elsewhere, the big races, and that was a big step for him.
It's one of those things you often see with great drivers, isn't it? They kind of make an opportunity. It's kind of a cometh the hour, cometh the man type thing. Obviously, wet conditions in that race. And it was just a point where his just irresistible ability couldn't help but catapult him onto the world stage almost. And Mark, I guess that kind of tells us this was a driver of unusual ability. He had everything, both the skills behind the wheel and the off-track initiative, shall we say, to really make something of himself.
Yeah, I'm sure him and his, and maybe his father as well, were hustling a little bit behind the scenes to make it all happen for him. But as you say, when he got the opportunity, there was never any question. And that Jaguar situation is sort of paralleled later on in Formula One at Mercedes, when he was in consideration for a drive in 54, when he'd yet really to establish himself in Grand Prix. And it was, he tested for them, tested very impressively, but it was suggested that he was maybe not quite experienced enough yet and should do a season, which is when they got the 250F that Richard was talking about. And in the Italian Grand Prix that year, he was leading Mercedes and leading Ascari's Ferrari. So, you know, again, just underlining in red that his natural place was at the top team.
Yeah, of course, which led to that Mercedes opportunity. But again, an example of a driver who is in a position to try and grab the attention, is able to deliver. I think he won the Gold Cup in the Maserati, didn't he? And obviously this is a driver who sees himself, and this is where the self-confidence is. He clearly sees himself as being someone capable of lining up alongside Juan Manuel Fangio at Mercedes, as he did in 1955. And although he went into that with and conducted himself with humility, he knew that Fangio was the man in that team. You get the feeling that there was underlying all that feeling that he knew he deserved to be there. And I guess, yeah, the self-belief again, isn't it, Richard?
Yes. In fact, he'd had such confidence that before the 1954 season, he and his manager had applied to Mercedes. They knew Mercedes were coming back, and they'd say, you know, and he said, can I have a seat in the team? And they said, no, that's, go and get some more experience. That's when he got the Maserati and proved, you know, to their satisfaction that he was good enough for a seat in 1955. And that was a very important year for him, because he spent most of the season following very closely in Fangio's wheel tracks and watching, you know, the master of racecraft at work at very close quarters. And he was, as you said, you know, he was always very modest about his standing compared with Fangio. He won the British Grand Prix at Aintree, which was historically very significant. No one will ever know whether Fangio made a very diplomatic and very civilized and charming gesture by allowing him to win the race by a matter of feet sitting behind him in a reversal of the usual order, but nevertheless, you know, he won it. And he certainly proved himself to be Fangio's equal in sports cars for Mercedes that season too, winning the Mille Miglia and the Tour Florio with Peter Collins.
Well, that's the interesting thing with the comparison with Fangio's always being made, and obviously it's not the most fair comparison in that that was Fangio kind of at his peak and with a lot of experience, whereas Moss was still on the up. But it is interesting, isn't it, that comparison, because in sports cars it was equal to Fangio, even the better, actually, you would argue. And that 55 season, he was extremely strong in sports cars. If there was a driver's championship for a world championship for sports cars, he'd have won it. Mercedes obviously won the what was a manufacturer's championship. But again, you have that famous Mille Miglia victory is kind of the foundation of a big part of the legend, with that wonderful the Dennis Jenkinson Motorsports article. He was co-driving, and that's just a big part of the legend, and also the preparation that a driver like that was able to have. Obviously, it's the 1,000-mile race between Rome and Brescia, so you can't learn the circuit, but you can approach it almost with a rallying mentality with pace notes. And sure enough, he won an absolutely stunningly difficult race with relative ease.
Yeah, I think you have to. In sports cars, he was absolutely incomparable at that time. I think he was definitely faster than Fangio. Sterling had asked Fangio sometime post-career, I think, why was it you weren't as quick in sports cars as in Formula One? And Fangio replied he likes to be able to see the wheels, and he didn't feel at ease if he couldn't see the wheels. And the one time that the Mercedes entered the Formula One streamliner at a road circuit at Silverstone, he was a little bit at sea, so there might have been something in that. But Sterling didn't bother him either way. And like you say, we're not comparing like with Fangio at his peak and Moss in his second full season of F1, and even then there was very little in it. And I was once interviewing him about Monaco 61, another of his great races, and I asked if he believed he was performing to that 61 level when he was at Mercedes, and he replied no, he didn't believe he was, and that he believed he just steadily got better and better. And that's how it looks when you analyse his career. I believe the best stuff was towards the end.
Yeah, I guess as you would expect, ultimately, but I guess that was where, in the public consciousness, he was really starting to build up, because this was the great Fangio, who had already won several world championships by that time. So he was the master. But here was Moss kind of in his wheel tracks and doing far better than what anyone else had done alongside Fangio at Mercedes. Obviously, they had Carl Kling, Hans Herrmann was around, you know, good drivers, but not in the same class, whereas Moss actually showed that he could be of that kind of caliber. And I guess it's a shame that everything that happened with Mercedes in 55, the Le Mans disaster, which also potentially cost Moss a Le Mans victory, and Mercedes quite rightly withdrew from that race. It's interesting to imagine what might have happened had Mercedes continued, and whether Moss might have eventually been able to transcend Fangio. As you say, he was on that big upward curve. It's one of those one of the many what ifs, I guess, about Stirling Moss's career. But he kind of ended up going down after Mercedes, the back to driving British cars, Van Wall and later for Rob Walker. And this is kind of the peak years for him, I guess, you would argue, when he was really at his best. But Richard, do you think that particularly the success with Van Wall and the British Grand Prix was the kind of peak in terms of the British perspective of Stirling Moss, in that finally here was a guy who won the Grand Prix in a British car in difficult circumstances, so really just finally showed that that this country had transitioned into becoming a top line place for Grand Prix racing?
Yes, it was a very significant season. Moss won the British Grand Prix at Aintree in 57. With sharing a car with Tony Brooks. Moss's own Van Wall had broken down, and Brooks had had a big accident at Le Mans and wasn't feeling great. So when Moss retired, he took over Brooks's car and resumed the race in ninth place, and eventually won with the aid of a bit of luck. because Jean Berard and Mike Hawthorne, who were first and second, both retired late in the race. Nevertheless, it was a fantastic triumph. But then I think more significant were the next two races he won, which were both in Italy, one at Pescara, which had been slotted into the calendar because several races had been cancelled after the Suez crisis, and then at Monza, where he took on the Italian teams, the full strength of the Ferrari and Maserati teams, and beat them soundly. And that, I think, set the seal on the rise of British teams and drivers in Grand Prix racing. And after that, with Cooper and Lotus entered by Rob Walker, you know, he was able to lead the confirmation of that new British supremacy.
And of course, Mark, that did matter, didn't it? Because having a driver winning for Mercedes or Maserati at the top levels he did in 56 mattered. But doing it in a van wall, British Racing Green, was just a huge achievement, and something that, with all the struggles that British Grand Prix cars had had, something that people had almost started to give up hope of.
Yeah, and those wins really broke the dam. And the statistically, it happened at Aintree, but yeah, the particularly the Pescara race was, and that was one of his most astonishing performances. And he beat Fangio's Maserati by well over 2 minutes. It was just a fantastic display of that combination was the fastest around. It wasn't just a result based upon the misfortune of others. It was here was a British car, British driver dominating and beating the best in the world, and that went on into 58 when Van Wall won the inaugural Constructors' Championship with Moss and Tony Brooks on the driving strength, and Moss just lost out to Mike Hawthorne, who was driving for Ferrari at the time, by a single point. So even though a Ferrari driver won the title, it was a British driver there as well. So it was a British constructor winning the inaugural championship and a British driver in the Ferrari winning the Drivers' World Championship. So it really underlined that the country had arrived as a force.
And with mention of Pescara 57, Richard, as you are the author of The Last Road Race, which is a fascinating book about that, I'm obliged to ask you a bit more about it, because it was a phenomenal event, and both in itself, obviously the Coppa Acerbo at Pescara had been going on for a while. It was already a famous race. This was its one appearance as a world championship event, but it was also that kind of crucial time, wasn't it, which is obviously the way the book comes together, not just bringing together a remarkable race, but the important stories of particularly the Britons in Grand Prix racing. Can you just tell us a little bit about that race and why it's so important for Grand Prix racing and for Moss as well, of course, as the winner?
Well, it always fascinated me because it was a race and a circuit that wasn't on the regular World Championship calendar. It was a 15-mile circuit, the longest that's ever been used in the Formula One World Championship. It began on the seafront in Pescara, which is on the Adriatic coast, sort of on the other side of Italy from Rome, kind of directly across. So the race began in front of temporary grandstands and temporary pits on the seafront, and then took a right turn up into the hills, and the cars raced through on perfectly ordinary roads through mountain villages before setting back off down a very fast stretch downhill towards the coast again, and then a long, long, long straight back to the finish. Very high-speed circuit, very dangerous because of the speeds and because of the complete lack of any sort of safety precautions whatsoever. You know, hardly a straw bale anywhere, never mind anything like Armco barriers or anything at all. There was no entry fee for spectators, because if you lived in the village and the race went through it, you know, you watched from outside your house or sitting on an earth bank. I loved all that. I loved the way the drivers got to the race. Stirling and his dad flew to Rome, Stirling, where they picked up a Fiat 1100 rental car and drove across to Pescara, about 3.5 hours through the mountains, the Abruzzi. Roy Salvadori and Tony Brooks got there in a Hillman Minx, which one of them was road testing for a magazine, Autocar, I think. Jack Brabham, who was racing for Cooper, got there by driving the Cooper Transporter from Surbiton to Pescara in the days before any sort of motorways at all. He drove the car transporter there and back. And I loved all those stories. Life was so different for them. You know, they'd get there a few days before the race. They'd all go swimming together. You know, they'd have dinner together, have a good time. They'd check out the course in their rental cars. Bruce Halford, who was racing a Maserati, learnt the course by racing his transporter round, or his sort of truck rather than a transporter, round the course, because he didn't want to risk driving his Maserati in case he broke something and couldn't afford a spare part or couldn't get one. So, you know, it was a different way of going about racing. I mean, the two facts about that race I love, one of which is that by the last couple of laps, when there were only half a dozen cars left, kids would go out and play in the road between the arrival of the cars, you know, such big gaps, and their parents would listen out for the cars. And when they could hear, a Ferrari or a Van Wall coming, you know, they'd clear the kids off the road so the cars could go past. And the other one is Jack Brabham ran out of petrol on the last lap, all the shops and filling stations and everything were closed. You saw a filling station, coasted into it, thought, oh, well, I'll wait for the race to end and then I'll get somebody to come and pick me up. But suddenly a bloke jumped out from the filling station office and poured a couple of litres of petrol into his, well, something or other, petrol into his tank, and off he went to finish the race. So, you know, I love those stories and Moss's victory, and it seemed heroic in a different kind of way from races on permanent circuits.
It's interesting when you look at Moss's career, Mark, the success he had on these types of circuit, winning at Pescara, famous one at Mia, the Targa Florio, won the German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring. I think he won the Nürburgring 1,000 kilometres 4 times, 3 times Monaco Grand Prix, went out and won there in 500s as well. So on these really challenging tracks with no margin for error, with huge consequences for getting it wrong, he was a guy who consistently achieved, which I guess, again, testament to that self-belief, but also the precision to be able to perform at that level without making a mistake that could be fatal.
Yeah, it's about how good you were was amplified in those extreme circumstances, and that belief in how good you were as well. Because if you look at the difference back then between a very great driver and a good driver, if you look at the lap times on a qualifying grid, it might be second and a half or something like that, which in today's F1 would just be, wouldn't be tolerated. You can't be that far off your teammate. But that's because now you can see and push beyond the limits and then come back down to them. You didn't have that luxury then. You had to drive to your ability, and when the consequence wasn't just a trip to the gravel trap or the Armco, but it was possibly to the morgue, then you couldn't take liberties in the same way. So the natural level became, the natural order became much more apparent.
And of course, during this period of his career, this is where he really earned that epithet as the greatest driver never to win the World Championship. Now, some people rail a bit against that, and obviously the World Championship isn't the be-all and end-all, but I think it actually says something about Moss that he's able to be remembered as one of the absolute all-time greats, despite not having that kind of weight of numbers of championships. He hasn't got Fangio's 5 World Championships, but it actually doesn't matter. He's still up there in that pantheon. I mean, Richard, do you actually think that almost perversely not winning a world championship was almost better for the Moss legend than winning, say, one, if he just picked off one of them and hadn't had the bad luck that cost him?
Yes, he always said that. He would rather have been known as the man who never won the world championship but deserved to, rather than just one of several who won it once. You know, I think the very greatest world champions won it more than once, and he didn't want to be numbered among, you know, the one-time winners. I think clearly he would have loved to have won the world championship, and he deserved to win it. And he deserved to win it several times. And perhaps if the accident in 1962 hadn't intervened, that would have come true. But I do think there's a special distinction to be accepted as the greatest of that era after Fangio, and yet not to have, you know, to have been denied the prize very cruelly. That's something very poignant, and it was uniquely his.
Yeah, we should mention 1958 and the Portuguese Grand Prix, of course, shouldn't we, Richard, where Moss helped to exonerate Mike Hawthorn from a disqualification. And then Moss, of course, later in the year went on to miss the World Championship. But I think it was just a point, having saved these points for Mike Hawthorn. So that, again, adds to the legend, doesn't it, the decency of the man.
Yes, the closest he came to winning the World Championship was 1958, when he and Mike Hawthorn were more or less neck and neck through the season. Stirling won more races, but there was the significant incident took place at Oporto in the Portuguese Grand Prix, a race that Stirling won. Hawthorn was a fairly distant second, but on the last lap, Hawthorn spun and the car stalled, and he tried to restart it in the direction of the circuit, but that was slightly uphill and couldn't get it going. And Stirling was going past on his lap of honour and stopped and said, look, don't do that, turn it round and start it the other way. And Hawthorn did that, got it started, finished the race in second place, but then was called before the stewards and was disqualified because he'd pushed the car against the direction of the circuit. Stirling voluntarily went to the meeting of the stewards and told them, no, don't disqualify him, because, you know, he wasn't actually on the track when he started it against the direction of the race. He was actually on the pavement, so he's all right. And the stewards accepted that and restored Hawthorn 6 points for coming second, as you got in those days. You got 8 for a win, 1 for fastest lap, and 6 points for second. So a couple of races later, the last race of the season, Stirling did everything he needed to do, won the race, got the fastest lap, but Hawthorn finished in second place and was able to pip him to the title by a single point, which, of course, you could trace back to Stirling speaking on his behalf in Portugal. So that was an example of great sportsmanship, and he never, ever uttered a word of regret about it. In fact, he said, perhaps truthfully, that if the positions had been reversed, Hawthorn would have done the same for him, which says a lot about the way people, racing drivers, went about their business in those days.
It wasn't only that. Also, the scoring system that Richard talks about, where you only got, there was only difference of 2 points between first and second. If they adopted the later system that ran for a couple of decades, which was 9 points for a win and 6 for second, Moss would comfortably win that 58 title because he had 4 victories to Hawthorn's 1. So if you applied the same scoring system in 58 as we had subsequently, that would have been Moss's title. In 59, it was only the unreliability of the Colotti gearbox on Rob Walker's privately entered Cooper rather than the different gearboxes on the works Coopers that cost him that title. His broken back at Spa in 1960 cost him 4 races in the Lotus. So there's 3 consecutive titles at least he could have had. And as Richard said, if his career hadn't been curtailed, who knows how many more there might have been. So I don't think that the statistics really are worth getting too caught up on.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that when you also have fewer rounds, it's more easy for the wrong driver to win, if you want to put it that way. But it's interesting how those just opportunities went there, because like the Spa accident you mentioned, that was a wheel detached from the car. That wasn't a driver error. The unreliability of the gearbox, obviously Stirling Moss wasn't in the position that Jack Brabham was, because Jack Brabham had basically modified some Citroen gearboxes for the works coopers. He'd used his skills to put in some modifications to it to strengthen it. So just all these small little factors. But even so, during that period, you know, just so many great wins. You're sort of trying to tick off all the great victories. But another one is Argentina, Mark, in 58, which was an unlikely win, but another one that shows a different aspect of Moss's skill set.
Yeah, I mean, that was a tactical bluff over the Ferrari Maserati teams. So it was just a converted, uprated Formula 2 Cooper owned by Rob Walker. And it was a late entry to the race because Van Wall, Stirling's contracted team, couldn't make it because they hadn't adapted their engines to the new regulation fuel of that year in time. So Stirling had the idea of just borrowing Rob Walker's Cooper along with the mechanic Alf Francis. And being an F2 car, it wasn't, the F2 races didn't have pit stops in them, unlike the Grand Prix of the time. And so it didn't have the single spinner on the wheel to so they could make a quick tyre change. Had just like a conventional road car, just four bolts. So a pit stop was going to take, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. So Stirling and Alf Francis just came up with the bluff that they're obviously not going to be contenders because they would lose so much time in the pits. But of course, they didn't make a pit stop. They just fueled the car up and ran very gently early on and just gradually made their way to the front. And by the time it was realised in the Ferrari pits that he actually wasn't stopping and his tyres were down at the canvas, it was too late. And Luigi Musso in second was too far back by the time it was realised. And so, yeah, it was a clever win, but it was the win that actually brought the walls down in terms of the British domination of the sport. You know, we talked about how in 57 with Van Wall it was confirmed Britain's place, but in 58 it was the Britain's way of specialist constructors with the mid-engine cars and proprietary engines and gearboxes that came to dominate the sport for the, well, arguably right until today. That was what the Cooper win signified. So yeah, again, another very significant moment in the sport's history, and Stirling's there.
One of the things I loved about that race in Buenos Aires was that Alf Francis actually put out fresh wheels and tyres on the pit counter to fool the Ferraris and Maseratis into thinking they were definitely going to make a pit stop, and then they never did. And as you say, the tyres were right down to the canvas by the time Moss finished the race.
There's also the story about Stirling Moss spending lots of time before the race walking around griping about the fact that it took ages to change the wheels and it was going to be a problem. So just just putting that thorough gamesmanship, which I think you see in any great driver. But again, this thing about Moss's great drives, and Richard, I was looking at a piece you wrote on the Guardian site, picking out his five greatest wins, and that included 58 Argentina. But there's just so many to choose from that I imagine squeezing it into five is nigh impossible, because all five of those that you picked, which are the Miami 56 Italian Grand Prix, Argentina 58, Nürburgring 1000 kilometers in 59, and then the famous 1961 Monaco Grand Prix, you know, those are all, in most other drivers' body of work, that would be their comfortably, any one of those would be their best race by a country mile, probably.
Yeah, and it would have been very easy to pick five more. Very, very easy indeed. You know, another one of the, or possibly two of the Nürburgring 1000 Ks, the 1950 Dundrod TT, all sorts of races that in which he proved himself to be, you know, absolutely exceptional.
And we should, Mark, talk a little bit more about the relationship with Rob Walker, obviously the great privateer team successes in Formula One. Again, never quite won the World Championship, and it was driving for Rob Walker that, of course, his career came to an end. But that period, and I guess Argentina 58 prefaced that, given it was Walker's car, but 59-61 driving with great success for Rob Walker in Cooper Machinery, Lotus Machinery. Even during that period, won the only Formula One race for a four wheel drive car in the Ferguson at Alton Park in the Gold Cup. But you know, that's one of the great driver team partnerships and relationships, isn't it? And the fact they could take on the manufacturers in that period and the works teams was again another big part of the legend.
Yes, and I think after 58 he sort of cured himself of chasing the title. He rather took to the idea of being the underdog and proving his brilliance regardless of the circumstances. So that fitted nicely. You'd get Rob would have last year's Cooper or last year's Lotus, and they'd go against the works cars, and it as we say, it cost them the championship to the works Coopers in 59. Interesting aside that the Citroen based gearbox that Jack Brabham enjoyed, that gave him that crucial advantage over Stirling. Jack had sourced those from a French scrapyard and modified them himself. But it just the partnership with Rob was just a perfect gentleman's agreement. They would share prize money, but there wasn't a contract as such, and they just that's how it was. And it was all set to continue into 62, but in partnership with Ferrari. Ferrari had basically offered Stirling most of the world and said, you know, you can just tell me what you want, give me a list of demands. And Stirling had said, well, he wanted Rob to run the car. He didn't want to run from the works. And Ferrari had agreed even to that. So that's how strong that relationship had become between Stirling and Rob by then.
Well, with mention of that, Richard, we should cast our minds back to earlier in his career and the Bari incident with Ferrari that obviously was the reason why Moss never raced for Ferrari, despite being massively admired by Enzo. And obviously that's a good example of why you don't put off superstar drivers with your treatment of them, isn't it?
Yes. In 1951, Enzo Ferrari had obviously, you know, clocked Stirling's precocious talent, invited him down to Bari, to the Bari Grand Prix in Puglia, to drive one of his cars. It was a non-championship race. It was obviously a good opportunity to give a young driver a try. Stirling and his dad drove all the way down to Bari, even further than to Pescara, a long way from London, and got there. And they discovered that there was only one Ferrari there, and that Ferrari had changed his mind and was had given it to Piero Taruffi, a much more experienced driver, of course, who'd driven for Ferrari for some time. And there was no car for Moss. They let him out briefly in it in practice, but he couldn't race it. And he was furious, and understandably so. He'd been treated in a very high-handed way. So he went home vowing never to drive for Ferrari again, and always said that he took special pleasure in beating the Ferraris. But then in between the 1961 and 62 seasons, they had a meeting in Maranello at the Ferrari headquarters, and Ferrari did, as Mark said, offered him a Formula One car that Rob Walker's team could paint in their dark blue colours and prepare themselves and run themselves, and also a 250 GTO for sports car and GT races. That's one of the great unknowns. You know, Stirling crashed and his career finished before that offer became concrete. Having been all conquering pretty much in 1961, the Ferrari of a modified 156 of 1962 was actually a bit of a dog. And so who knows what would have happened, whether Stirling would have had another disappointing underdog car, or whether Alf Francis would have been able to work a bit of magic on it and turn it into the winner that it certainly wasn't in the works hands. So that's, you know, that's a great unknown.
Yeah, and of course, what actually happened was his career ended in April 62. Big crash at Goodwood. I mean, Mark, that was the ultimate abrupt halt to a career, wasn't it? He tried to come back briefly. He did drive a car, but it's clear he felt he didn't quite have that. He'd lost some of that edge and promptly retired. But it's amazing to think that had that accident not happened, he could have, who knows how long he could have carried on for. If he carried on to the same age someone like Jack Brabham did in Grand Prix racing, he could have still been there in the early 1970s, age-wise. So a lot of Moss's career was lost to that. It wasn't like it cost a few years. It potentially cost us easily a decade or more, even more perhaps, of Moss competing in the front line.
Yes, well, he always said he had no intention of stopping. You know, subsequently, he said, had he not had that injury, he would have just kept going. He would have kept going indefinitely as long as he was still quick. And he was only 32 when he had the accident. So, yeah, it's quite conceivable he could have had another decade at least in him. I think he probably would have gone on to form a partnership with Ferrari. As Richard touched on, I don't think the 62 season would have been anything special. I think the cars were outdated by the Lotus 25 by then. But when you look at the cars that they subsequently came up with in the John Surtees era, if you imagine Moss and those, you can imagine them going head-to-head with Clark for the next few years. And I think his stature and the old man's understanding of his level would have focused Ferrari, and I think they would have enjoyed a lot of success together. And maybe as Ferrari was overtaken by the Cosworth DFV technology from 67 onwards and before the Fiat money had arrived, you know, Ferrari was struggling a little bit. Maybe Stirling would have moved on at that point, but just imagining them in a Ferrari P4 or a Ferrari 512S sports car, it sends shivers down the spines, because it would have just been such a wonderful combination. But yeah, he always said he saw himself probably would have retired sometime in the 1970s had injury not intervened. But I mean, given the era that we're talking about, that was a very big presumption, wasn't it? If it hadn't, when he injured in 62, he could easily have been injured in the subsequent time. He couldn't really plan on do much long-term career planning in those times.
He liked a family atmosphere in a team, which he got at Maserati and to some extent at Mercedes, and certainly with Rob Walker. And that, to me, puts a bit of a question mark against his relationship with Ferrari. The Scuderia Ferrari was always, and always has been, still is, a very political place. And I'm a little bit like John Surtees in that respect. I'm not sure how Stirling would have got on with that in the long term.
History does suggest there'd have been a falling out. I should take this opportunity to promote your Ferrari book as well, which is another very good read. I'd forgotten to mention that earlier. At this time of lockdown, people have got plenty of time to read, so I'm trying to get as many recommendations out as possible. But we should still talk about Moss's post-frontline racing career. Obviously, he was still high profile. He did return to race historics regularly. I think it was 2011 was the last time he tried to commit. I think he retired after qualifying for a historic race supporting the Le Mans 24 Hours. And of course, he did do a few bits of contemporary racing. He turned up at Bathurst in the 70s, and he did do a couple of years in the British Touring Car Championship in an Audi, but the game had moved on quite a bit there. But he was just this... He was just played such a totemic role, didn't he? In that he was, because as we said earlier, he was so sort of accessible and alive. He kind of kept that spirit and that name alive. And for people who were born long after Moss retired to be able to see him in action, I mean, I was able to see him race in historics. Just fantastic to see this absolute legend, not just racing very, very occasionally, but turning out relatively regularly in historic kit. And I guess that says a lot about his passion for racing, doesn't it, Richard?
Yes, I was lucky enough to see him drive a Vanwall, not in the 50s, but in 1979 in a kind of demonstration before the Italian Grand Prix at Monza. And to see him at Monza driving that car was just sensational. And I saw him in a Mercedes W196 at Melbourne a few years ago at Albert Park, where, of course, in a Maserati, he'd won the Grand Prix that had coincided with the Olympic Games in 1956. And he loved doing that. He loved showing people himself in the cars of that era. And, it, you know, so you feel, you know, I feel I saw Stirling Moss in a van wall. That's a kind of priceless feeling, actually. And he was so good at that. And, you know, he had that terrible accident when he was 80 years old, when he got into the empty lift shaft at his home in Mayfair and fell 30 feet, broke his ankles, damaged vertebrae. And within 6 months, I saw him at the Goodwood Revival racing his little Oscar sports car, you know, not just driving it, racing it. At that age, having done that to himself, extraordinary powers of recovery, as we'd seen throughout his career. So that kind of post-career, the long post-career of Stirling Moss was an extraordinary thing and gave pleasure to an enormous number of people.
Yeah, and certainly shows his enormous toughness. I mean, Mark, when we reflect on Moss's career, we've mentioned the greatest driver ever to win the World Championship. Obviously, we talked about his sports car success. He was good in saloon cars as well, had a little bit of rallying success. So he's, as well as being one of the great Grand Prix drivers, one of the great sports car racers, he's also one of the greatest versatile racing drivers as well. He's one of those people who just ticks all the boxes, doesn't he? He was quick in absolutely everything, and also took the game on off track, as we've talked about, in terms of his professionalism and his attitude. He was just one of those defining bar racing drivers, wasn't he?
Yeah, his talent translated in every type of car, basically, in every discipline within the sport. I think probably helped that the cars were more basic and the tyres were more basic back then, so the technique was maybe less specialised than it is today, but so that just allowed you a clearer window on that genius, really. Like a few years ago, when Fernando Alonso first tried an LMP1 Le Mans car, he was significantly adrift of the pace of the regulars like Anthony Davison and Sebastian Buemi. But he got there eventually. But when even someone of that level and renowned adaptability of Alonso can't just climb in a car and be fast, it tells you how much more specialised it's become. And I think back then, the talent could be seen crystal clear in a way it can't with more sophisticated machinery.
And Richard, your kind of final reflection, I mean, he is one of those handful of all-time greats, isn't he? There's not even really a debate to be had there.
No, there isn't. You know, you wouldn't like to have to judge between Nivolari and Fangio and Moss and Clark and whoever you pick from the, you know, Senna from the more recent eras. But he just, in our eyes, you know, to British fans particularly, he just stood above, stood for something special, for some qualities that we still see in racing drivers, that we still look for in racing drivers today.
Yeah, and it's just that the reaction to his loss has just shown that still resonates with everyone today. And I guess the final, you just had to reflect, just what an incredible life to have had so much success, to have had a long life, and to have been healthy to relatively late in his life. Obviously, the last few years were tough, but just an amazing story. Somebody who touched so many people, those who knew him well speak very highly of him, but also those who never met him and only saw him from afar had a real hero to admire. So I guess, Mark, from that perspective, it's, you just had to reflect on a well-played innings, I guess.
Yes, on a life well-lived. I think the best way of thinking about it is he and the world got to enjoy each other for a very long time. And I think that's a nice consoling thought.
Yeah, well, by his own admission, he certainly enjoyed himself on and off track, and why not? When you're that good, you absolutely deserve to. Well, we hope we've at least done some justice to the legend that is Stirling Moss. We could have talked for 4 hours, 10 hours about the guy. Many, many races of just amazing level of performance, a genuine all-time great. But I do recommend, again, read Richard Williams' books. They are always excellent. The Last Road Race, Ferrari, and the Dick Seaman book, The Race with Love and Death. Absolutely outstanding. And do head to therace.com. You'll be able to read Mark Hughes' appreciation of Stirling Moss on there, as well as all the latest on the world of motorsport. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and also check out our other podcasts, including our retro podcast, Bring Back V10s. So stay home, stay safe, and join us next time.